Thank you for, you know, letting this presentation be sandwiched in between two excellent ones. Also, thanks to the organizers for having me, and also for letting me be part of this grant that is, you know, like the Aspirations grant that I'm a part of, that helps me to go beyond what I've been doing before, which had to do with internet, so like all virtual kind of stuff. So I'm very happy to looking at artists and art has been what I wanted to do for my dissertation, and now I get to go back to do this. So just a brief background. I've been working on, you know, the internet in China. So I've been doing 18 months field work in Beijing, actually trying to link the internet with the urban, which is an ongoing project. And now I'm like, you know, substituting the internet with, you know, art and artifacts, artworks. So it's like something people can actually see and touch, rather than, maybe that's, you know, I have high hopes doing this, put it that way. Because I actually believe that, you know, one of, we live standing with one foot in the virtual world and one in the virtual world, some more, some less. So I think, you know, this conference may be less, because there's not so many, you know, electronic gadgets around. When I was attending a blogger conference in Beijing a few years back, everybody was like at the same time, you know, listening to some person talking, playing with their pets, pots, and, you know, all kinds of other instruments. So I don't know to what extent the internet will feature later on in this research, but I have high hopes. Now, what I promised in the abstract, let me foolishly repeat that to you. I promised how, you know, to show how practitioners imagine and image the urban in their work, how they reproduce their aspirations in their art, and then I promised to contextualize how these works of art and their interventions into dominant narratives connect to the urban aspirations of their creators and curators, people involved in, you know, art. And I promised how these aspirations have emerged and traveled through space, because, you know, art being like a process, right? The artist kind of growing over time, and his works of art being the, like, you know, cornerstones that you can look at and actually kind of track, maybe, you know, to some extent, how aspirations have grown in the past. Unfortunately, there's a problem. I haven't conducted my fieldwork yet. So that's not really a big problem. I could just, you know, pontificate about what the paper is going to be about anyway, right? But there's the other problem, is like, to paraphrase Manuel Castells, this is not going to be a book or a paper about books. So I don't want to do that, because it might, you know, freeze my brain or something. So basically all I can do today, I think, is say a few words about my positionality, general thoughts on the topic, and then show some images of fields of, you know, my field sites, the two sites that I have identified in Beijing that I want to go to and, you know, talk to artists. I know some artists and curators, etc., from my fieldwork before, and so, you know, but in China, it's the problem, maybe in other countries as well, is that unless you actually go there, they don't take you seriously. Like, you know, you need to kind of reawaken the contacts, and so I wonder how I'm going to do that in like a very short fieldwork time, but that's another story. I'll try. Okay, so talk about alliterations. I also like this agency, you know, consisting of aspiration and action. It's kind of, I see it as a duality. Like, first there is the aspiration, that's basically on the level of consciousness, And then at some, and you know, it's growing slowly or changing slowly. And then at some point it becomes visible in forms of action that people can, you know, see, measure, write about. However, I'm trying to, you know, expand that vision by also trying to write about the aspiration, the process of aspiration itself. Tim has talked much better than I could about the definitions of aspirations, so I'm going to leave that out here. So in terms of positionality, one thing that really defines me, and I'm sorry if I'm boring, is that I'm very disenchanted with academia at times. I feel that when I read the big names, you know, like Foucault, etc., as a graduate student, I feel, yeah, this is an elaborate theory, like very beautiful. You know, you can, like something you read before you fall asleep and, like, you know, really interesting. But over time, over the decades, you know, when they develop the theory, like, I feel they have written agency out of the equation. And maybe, you know, maybe they also come to that same realization. Once they're older and wiser, they realize their mistake. And like, for example, Foucault in 1979, he started getting interested in the Iranian Revolution, etc. And after that, he really changed his writing a lot. The stuff he gets cited for is the stuff, mostly the stuff earlier. But the stuff that I find very interesting is the stuff later, which is often in French, etc., where he gave lectures before his death in 84. And I say this on the record here. Where he talks, tries to revive the idea of the free subject. Like, you know, so that matches my own interest in the individual agency kind of story. But I'm not planning to use Foucault in this work much. But another such person is Manuel Castells. He has started out in the 90s writing about, you know, social morphology being more important than social action. He wrote his big trilogy about, you know, basically the space and flows and space of places. I'm not sure to what extent you're familiar with that. But he's basically always maintained, the first 5 or 10 years he has maintained that space of flows are more important than space of than space of places. Then there is this, you know, little known article in 99 about grassrooting the space of flows. So I think, and I asked him about it, I was one of his students, and he also wrote that in another book that's written about him. That, you know, this, like, he changed his mind over time and, you know, revised the idea that, you know, space of flows, like the structural kind of things, are more important than the local space of places, like things that happen in there. And he picks up that idea in his latest book, 2012, not his latest, he has two in 2012. Very prolific, Networks of Outrage and Hope, where he invents this, or he creates this idea of the spaces of autonomy that, you know, like, stand there. Those are spaces where outrage can turn into hope, where, you know, outrage leads to kind of aspirations or, you know, some form of, and then through some form of what he calls togetherness, you create some kind of, you know, hope, and hope is the basis for action. I'm just, you know, paraphrasing and summarizing very briefly. And it sounds warm and fuzzy, right? Because those kind of things are hard to define. So I'm curious to hear your take on this. But I'm trying to emphasize that space, for me, as trained as a geographer, is like a key idea when I look at artists, etc. So one difficulty I have is that I think the only way to get at the content of this paper to be is by asking people about it and to look at, you know, the work they produce, whether that be sculptures or paintings or writings. That's, I mean, you know, that was also my idea of when I looked at the internet. Like, I have to go and ask people. I can't just look, you know, at blogs and just, you know, write something about what I think is my interpretation of that. I have to triangulate, or whatever the term is, that with the actual people there and how they are rooted in their specific places and how they may have moved to Beijing. Like, for example, the art community, a lot of them are not usually based in Beijing, but they flock to Beijing, you know, as if drawn by some kind of invisible, you know, pulled by some invisible hook or something. Similar, like, in, you know, for example, Berlin, some of the friends I had when I grew up in Munich, they're in Berlin now because they want to do art. So, just briefly, I don't have that much time left. Tim has posed three questions last morning about aspirations. You know, what aspirations do people have? Where do these aspirations come from? And then the third one, kind of, how are they, you know, actualized or in specific places? How does the capacity to aspire changes and, you know, turn to like a capacity to act? So those are the key questions that I also plan to ask. And the way I see it is, you know, maybe like as a story, you know, like a process unfolding. Like, you can, maybe that's why I congratulate myself to talk to artists, because, you know, you can look at the works of art and you can maybe, I hope, trace back how their aspirations have changed over time. Maybe better than when I talk to, say, you know, well, other groups. So I'm very curious to hear all your input and criticism of, you know, these, what kind of things I could, you know, focus on looking at when I do my research. I'm very sorry that I didn't do it. I had planned to do it before the conference, but then time somehow ran out. So a few slides about the two spaces that I'm going to look at. One is called Qijioba 798 Art Space. That's the literal translation. Yishu Hongjian. First the map. I added that last night because everybody had one. If you're familiar with Beijing, no, who of you has been to Beijing? Less than Edinburgh. That's so disappointing. Yeah, I encourage you to go there. It's a fascinating place. Those are the ring roads. The second ring road, there's no first ring road. Third, fourth, fifth, sixth. Right? And so, if you have an idea of Beijing property prices, you can imagine what the prices in this region are. Like higher than Singapore to some extent. That's crazy. So anyway, the first location of Qijioba 798 is here, which, as you can, you know, probably tell over time, it's getting more and more expensive to be here. But anyway, these are just some images. Most of them I pulled from Google. And from the internet, yeah. And it's the, they have all kinds of art going on there. Then, just to give you some impressions, some of them are politically rather, you know, explicit, more than one would expect. Some of them, I mean, because they're up to our own imagination to interpret, right? And one of the questions I have is to what extent, you know, should I allow myself to interpret these kind of things? Because I'm a Westerner, yes, I've been living in China for a few years and stuff, but it doesn't mean I understand, you know, what's going on. But of course, in, you know, dialogue with the artist, which I hope to have at least a few such dialogues, I try and find out more. Of course, as an artist, he may not have a specific, you know, aspiration doing a specific kind of work or a specific message to send. Maybe he's just keen to, you know, sell it for a very good price or something. I mean, the successful artists there, they're driving Porsche and, you know, they're doing really well, especially in this location. So anyway, there are some, political messages. Then there are some kind of things that I think are quite urban, like this is a scene of, you know, what really happened a lot, even now, in an urban environment, like people playing Chinese chess or whatever other board game. So there is an urban connection in, you know, the aspiration that goes into making the specific work of art, how that translates into the urban aspiration or the aspiration the artists have for themselves. I can, you know, only speculate now, which I'm reluctant to do.
Peter, this is all a repurposed industrial zone.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So they're really interesting stuff, right? I mean, I want to know what this means. This one is also funny. These kind of cars are Beijing Jipu Erling Erling BJ 2020. I've been driving one of those in Qingdao. I love this car. It's like, it always breaks and you have to kind of fix it yourself. And it's like really cheap. Like you can, the price might be approximately accurate. I mean, of course it's more. But nowadays you can't really drive it anymore because it's not allowed. I mean, they're just not safe enough, etc. And like the military was driving it. All kinds of people were driving it, you know. So I want to see to, and in cities too. Now they're kind of banned from cities. They're still sometime out there in the countryside. So there's like lots of interesting stories behind those works of art that I'm trying to get at. Of course, talking to specific artists that I'm going to be hopefully introduced to, and about their specific works of art, right? Rather than just something I pluck from the internet based on my own personal choice. It's a very big thingy. Like, there's a lot of galleries also. It's a big business, you know. And I think that part is important. Like, you know, I agree that this area, whatever you talk negatively about it, you know, all being about business, etc., is always kind of at least one of the core places where Chinese art came out of the shadows and found its personality and worth in the international art scene. It's also interesting to note that the Beijing art scene, all art scenes in a way, are very international. So there's a lot of roots, R-O-U-T-E-S, routes to look at, I think. So it's a very international art scene, thriving business. It's a tourism hotspot, so you should have gone there when you went to Beijing because it's number 3 or 4 after the Great Wall, Forbidden City, and Beijing Duck Restaurant. So that's one of them. The other one is Songzhuang Yishuchuan, Songzhuang Art Village or Artist Village. That is not here, but around in Tongzhou district, but it's more like around here. So you can see, like, it moved out of the city. It's this is, you know, see here, 5 kilometers. So this is like, when the traffic is very smooth, which it never is in Beijing, half an hour, you know. And like, you know, Beijing being a big, big city, so it's still, but even that place is being developed a lot now. Not yet. right, so I really like this place because some of the, you know, people who introduced me to it, they kind of introduced me to people living there, and there are still these traditional kinds of, more like countryside kind of buildings, but of course now Beijing has eaten all those places up where you could rent a cheap, you know, house, like what here would be in Singapore would be like a terrace house, but of course maybe only one story. and you can rent. You could rent it for, or you could buy it for a cheap, you know, for a low rent, etc. So a lot of the artists there were like, you know, the struggling kind and really interested in art. There's a lot of community kind of going on. There's galleries that are in like very picturesque settings. This is from a China Daily. I'm not sure, this is like kind of simplifying it, right? Songzhuang is where the real art happens, and 798 is where the money is made. That's not true anymore. Songzhuang, people there, a lot of them are also doing quite well, etc. But I do like this idea, which I think brings a lot of people to Beijing in the first place. Art can only thrive in a free environment. So if it's not free, then you make it free. Like, you create a lot of, I mean, you just live there and don't care about any kinds of intrusions by orderlies or something until you have to. So there's a lot of freedom in a way, like lived everyday kind of freedom. Just some other images. There was a so-called freedom art exhibition, oil paintings, some things that are clearly urban in their aspiration, but I have no idea how to, like, you know, without talking to the actual artist, how to write about this. So any clues would be helpful. So the recent change, there's like, you know, Songzhuang Art Center, looks very posh, right? And the master plan also, about, you know, the danger being that it will, I mean, it's very big, 4,000 artists. It's actually the largest one in Beijing. There's something called the Songzhuang spirit, free, artsy kind of spirit, which, yeah. But development threatens Tongzhou district. They have, everything gets, I mean, more expensive by the minute. Right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Next.